Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Austin Eckroat is a winner, first-time winner on the PGA Tour, taking the weather-delayed Cognizant Classic on Monday. But Rex, the big story and the first topic in our discussion today is the return of one Anthony Kim, DFL by 11, 33 shots behind eventual winner Joaquin Niemann. What do you make of what we finally saw after 12 long years from AK?
I don't know if that's the biggest story. I'm going to switch.
Biggest story of the week. It's the biggest story of the week.
I think the biggest story at this moment is, what am I going to get out of you for this podcast? Because you just got through gas bagging for 2 hours, an hour and a half. How much of these recycle takes do you have left? All right, so you've been spouting off for an hour 45. Normally, you get on this podcast and you've got nothing but takes, and you want to take up all the real estate in the world. But you look tired. You looked haggard. You have bags under your eyes. All of your takes are used and well-worn.
I do not have bags under my eyes because I'm heavily made up.
You are.
What I do have is a little bit of a head cold. So apologies in advance. I do sound a little bit nasally. It's either a head cold, sinus infection, whatever the case may be. I was down in Orlando, your neck of the woods, with extremely high pollen counts. And so, yes, I'm feeling a little bit under the weather. Long day. Went to the studio like 8 a.m. to watch the conclusion of the final round, and now we're sitting here recording this podcast at 3 p.m. Eastern time. So, yeah, I'm running a little bit on fumes. You're probably going to have to carry this one,
but I do
appreciate your love and consideration.
I knew I wasn't going to get maximum effort. That's what I was getting to you. Like, I knew I was going to get nothing but recycled and tired, and I'm a little groggy, and AK was fine. No, it was the biggest story. It was the biggest story of, I'd say, a decade, but it's been more than a decade since we've seen him. And we talked about this. I'm so wildly disappointed that I'm probably just like you. Every morning I would wake up and I would go straight to the website and I would want to read the transcripts, because I'm like, well, somebody dug in on him today. Someone asked him all the questions that we have. Someone asked him, where you been, man? What have you been doing? Why'd you come back? What do you hope to accomplish? Like, I could keep going on and on and on, and none of it. We got none of it. It was, how was your round? Well, my round was crappy, is the answer to that. He didn't play well. I don't think you or I or anyone who's been paying attention had any higher expectations than that. He finished dead last in the field. I guess we could have predicted that. He talked about the idea. He felt like he played better than he actually scored. And look, man, 12 years. It's been a long time. And just think, I mean, he's been literally been under a rock for 12 years. And he suddenly
We don't know where he's been.
And he suddenly just crawled out and struggled and didn't score very well. And I don't know what else we possibly could have expected. I mean, I think it would have been the story of the century had he come out and actually put himself into some sort of contention or played well. Because, like, that would have been shocking to me. This isn't shocking to me. The shocking part is, again, we don't know anything more about Anthony Kim's journey than we did 10 days ago. And that's driving me nuts. Honestly, I kind of want to go to the live event in Miami in a couple of weeks. I can't. I'm working that week in San Antonio. But because, I mean, I have so many questions. We have so many things that we just still don't know.
I want to be careful here, because when we did the podcast on Wednesday, and I believe it blew up unlike any podcast we've done prior.
Did it?
We asked rhetorically, based on Anthony Kim's own video that he posted on Instagram, where he concluded by saying, "Hello, haters, I'm back." And we asked, like,
who hates?
Who are the haters? Has been a beloved figure. He was a beloved figure on the PGA Tour. And no one has been, like, more beloved retrospectively than Anthony Kim. During these 12 years away, it's been a public fascination what happened to him, this yearning for him, this longing for him. And so that's how we began last week's podcast. And then everyone in the comments was like, you guys are the haters. You guys are just dogging on him. And you don't think he's going to be playing well. Of course he's not going to be playing well. And that's one point that I want to make. Like, I mentioned it on Golf Today during our roundtable. Like, I'm willing to give Anthony Kim some grace when it comes to his competitive return. Thinking that he was going to be shooting 67 in his live return was just wildly unrealistic. Whether it's Tiger Woods, whether it's Will Zalatoris, whether it's Gary Woodland, whether it's Bud Cauley, whether it's Patrick Cantlay a couple years ago when he was returning from his own back troubles. When you take an extended period of time, it takes weeks, if not months, to regain your competitive feels again. And for him to go 12 years, basically the exponential version of what we've seen for player comebacks, like, of course, you have to be willing to give him 3-4 starts, give him a couple months to find his footing. What was really befuddling to me, and we touched on it last week, Rex, was there's no context for this return. There was basically just bland press conference questions about his round that day, a save he may have had, how it felt to be back inside the ropes. We don't know why he's back inside the ropes. We don't know what spurred him to come back inside the ropes. We have no idea what his career aspirations are at age 38. All we know is just this. He shot 76, 76, 74. And he says that he's hit the ball well and it's disappointing to score like this, but he's optimistic for the rest of the season. That's it. That's all we know about this Anthony Kim return.
Yeah, he was sloppy. And again, I don't know that we should be surprised about it. And to your point, I think we should all give him a grace period, whatever that grace period needs to be, whether if it's the entire season, whether if we give him five or six starts, whatever the case may be. I'm not going to sit here and dog on him for going out and struggling in this first event. Again, I don't know if he would have come out and played well, how I could have even put that into context. Because you're right, there are no comparisons. I mentioned this earlier today on the roundtable. I think someone on the telecast over the weekend from PGA National kind of compared it to Michael Jordan, who, if you remember, went away for 3 years before coming back. And I guess I see sort of the edges of a comparison on that one, because it is a physical sport and he was of a certain age and you didn't know what to expect, but he had played baseball. It's not as though we didn't know what he had been doing. Like, we knew what MJ was doing when he walked away from the game. He was still active. He was still a professional athlete. He was still a specimen touched by God. We just don't have any idea. And look, I appreciate the fact it seems to me they wanted this to be a very soft landing for AK. It seems to me that they did not want him to be under the microscope, because he talked a lot about just it was important for him to be there and his daughter to be with him and to be part of this again. I understand all that. I will take umbrage with one thing you said. I think we all know his motivations. I think you called it his bag on golf today. And yeah, he came back for his bag. I don't think there's any other way to explain that. I don't think that's stepping out of bounds. It's definitely not being a hater. I think it's pretty obvious. I did kind of correct you a little bit and say that even before Live Golf became a thing, even before it became a thing that he could come back and get some version of guaranteed money from both either the PGA Tour or Live Golf, because make no mistake, the PGA Tour was going to find a way to give him guaranteed money.
As they should. As they should.
Absolutely. Like, he could have come back and played and they were going to have to work around some edges and maybe be a little shady about it, but they were going to find a way to get him to be paid, because we had talked a lot about the idea he had a insurance policy that was worth X amount. $10 million is the going rate, but no one really knows. But he had been talking about this, or I'd heard rumors about him coming back for years. It's why he was such a fascinating urban legend, because if he had just walked away and we didn't hear anything, that would have been one thing. But like, on the edges, you would hear about, yeah, he's hitting balls again. Like, he's feeling pretty good about it. Like, one day he wants to come back to the PGA Tour. I think the love is still there. I think the idea that he wants to compete is still there. We did see sort of a crack. There was like a video of him walking onto the range and Pat Perez sort of greeting him. He probably missed that. Just the idea of being part of what is a really cool club for everybody.
But you're saying you think, and probably do not know for sure.
Yeah.
What his motivations are and why he's coming back. We have zero context to this.
Oh, no. Again, his motivations is getting paid. Let's don't be silly.
How do you know?
Why do you think he would have come back at this moment in time? I think that's pretty clear. I don't know if I'm going out of bounds on this one. Maybe I am. Maybe I'm wildly off base and he's not getting paid a lick and he's doing this just because he wants to go out and have fun. I don't believe
that. And I'm sure Liv doesn't want him to come out and say, yeah, I'm doing this just because you're offering me a boatload of money. I have no idea how long this is going to last. Maybe it lasts 6 months. Maybe it lasts 6 years. I don't really know. But you have to offer something. You have to offer some reasonable explanation. Maybe it was the love of the game. Maybe Greg Norman insinuated on the broadcast, you know, he's got a wife and a two-year-old daughter now. At least trot out something that, hey, I want to do it for them, or I want to write a compelling final chapter to my career, right? You know, I've disappeared for a long time, but I still think I have a lot of game left and I want to finish my career how I started. Literally just say anything along those lines, because if you don't offer that explanation, if you don't offer that context, and he continues to play the way that he has, at least he showed over his first 54 holes, then it just becomes kind of this meaningless sideshow with no point and no purpose. And I think it would really be a kind of sad and unfortunate ending for the legion of fans that AK had in the late 2000s and who have kind of invested time, energy, and emotion either into his disappearance and wondering when he's going to be coming back or now in his comeback, if it does just kind of peter out with a bunch of 53rd place finishes. Like, there has to be something to grasp at.
Well, and he kind of said that he came back because he wanted his daughter to see him do what he did at a very good level. So I think if you want to call that context, I guess that was there. But again, like, there is such a story here. You're the storyteller. Like, you've got to get in your car and drive to Miami in a couple of weeks. Do you not? I mean, you have to try to write this story.
Wish I could. I'll be at the Augusta National Women's Amateur.
That's too bad. Tough scene. There is going to be a story written about him one day that I think is going to be fascinating. And Joe Beal.
But it has to include AK's voice.
And it might. I think eventually it might. Because, like, look, again, he was very sheltered, obviously, in Saudi Arabia. No one wanted to ask him any hard questions, whether if that was in the scrum area or on the broadcast. Either way, when he comes back stateside, again, a few weeks in Miami, my guess is that's going to change. You're going to have beat reporters who do this on a regular basis, who are going to ask the tough questions and are going to ask the probing questions. And maybe he sidesteps them and maybe he doesn't answer them, but I still think they're going to be there. And it would be such a compelling story. Like, I would love to read this from start to finish and to get an idea of exactly what he's feeling and what he's been through over the last 12 years. It's like, I don't know. I can't even put it into context. It's like a movie where someone just disappears. And I will say, and I thought Joe Beal from Golf Digest, who was on the roundtable earlier today with us, brought up a good point. I don't know if I particularly agree with it, but his point was, if he continues to play like this, if this is the norm, and again, not trying to hate, just saying that that is an option that could happen, that he could damage whatever this iconic status is that he's achieved. That all of these legions of fans would just sort of turn their nose up at him and walk away and say it wasn't worth the effort to be, you know, the fandom wasn't worth the effort. I don't know if I believe that, but I can see where it's coming from.
I certainly think that's a possibility. You know, was Jerry Rice's career damaged when he went to the Raiders and the Seahawks and he didn't finish his career as a 49er?
Michael Jordan's wasn't when he went to Washington.
No, I mean, I think there could have been a way that the AK story ended. And it appears now that it's probably going to be going in a little bit of a direction. He does play again this week in Hong Kong before a couple weeks off, where you and I will not be with him in Miami. But I'll be very curious to see what AK's media availability is for that week. And if they kind of make him a little bit more accessible than he certainly was for his return.
I would think they would want to leverage their investment at that point. And that's kind of cold. That's kind of harsh. I understand where people are coming from if they don't like it put that way. But they have made an investment because he's going to draw attention. People want to see how this story plays out. So why wouldn't you leverage it and put him in front of all of the cameras and all of the reporters and allow him to answer and fill in these blanks?
Rex, how about our two winners from this past week? Austin Eckroat prevails at PGA National tournament that ended on Monday after a very unfortunate weather delay that probably could have been foreseen by the PGA Tour. And how about Joaquin Niemann doing what Joaquin Niemann has seemingly done each and every time he tees it up over the past 3 or 4 months, and that is win the golf tournament in Jeddah. Which performance stood out to you more and why?
Eckroat, just because that's the one I was kind of focused on this morning. It spilled over into Monday, as you said, and just the way he performed. I mean, when you look at his ball striking, it was Scottie Scheffler-esque. He didn't lead the field in ball striking. Rory did, but it was very, very good, especially coming down the stretch for a young player who's never won before on what is a really, really difficult golf course. I think we talked about it in the podcast last week, that it seemed like it was the softer side of PGA National, but when it comes down, you get into the bear trap, you start playing those last few holes. He knew it was on the line and he had to execute a lot of really, really good shots. And it was really impressive. And I kept coming back to the idea that there is going to be a segment of the population that's going to look at another victory by a player that not your average sports fan or golf fan know about. And I'm just going to keep coming back to the idea that these full field events are what we thought they were. Like, this is what they're going to produce. Like, sure, Rory McIlroy could have won. Shane Lowry could have won at PGA National. But the odds are much more in favor that you're going to get an Eckroat or you're going to get a Nick Dunlap or one of these young players who has emerged. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I can imagine a world where 2 or 3 years from now, we're talking about him in sort of the same tones we talk about a Jordan Spieth or Scottie Scheffler. Now, that's lofty category. I'm not saying he's going to get there because he hadn't up until this point. But you look at what I saw on Monday morning and what I saw Sunday before the rain delay came. He's got all the tools. It's just a matter of him putting it together. Now, you brought up some good context. I did not realize that he wasn't even like, what was he? His last year at Oklahoma State, he was the third player on that team, the fourth player on that team.
Yeah, he was a top 25 college player. Everyone looks back to the 2017-2018 team, one of the best college golf teams in history, the team that had Matthew Wolf, the team that had Victor Hovland, Zach Boshu, who was on the KFT, was on that team. Brandon Jelly, who has performed well on the KFT. Sam Stevens has a runner-up finish in his career on the PGA Tour. Like, that team was absolutely stacked. And Austin Eckroat, as a freshman, was the 4 or 5 man on that squad. But he's, even as a senior, even after 3 years of seasoning, he was never a world beater. I mean, he won twice in college, and actually his performance in winning at the Cognizant Classic, this was his first win as a professional and his first win anywhere in 5 years since 2019. And so that's what I kind of took away from Monday's performance, Rex. Like, the quality of his play was sensational. He was aggressive through the ball. There was no steering. There was no tentativeness. And you look at the way he played in one of really the only other times he's been in serious contention on the PGA Tour. It was last year at the Nelson. He was in a 3-way tie for the lead, actually a very similar situation to what he had at PGA National. Shot 65 and ended up getting run down by Jason Day. This was the exact same kind of performance where he was almost clinical from tee to green. I think he missed just 2 fairways, missed just 4 greens. His putter's kind of always been kind of the bugaboo in the final rounds, but he was just good enough to get through here. That's kind of what I took away, is that this kind of speaks to the current level of depth on the PGA Tour, where a player who's been kind of above average PGA Tour player, nothing spectacular, but never really in danger over the past 2 years of losing his card, has a career week, and is able to win on the PGA Tour. I'm not projecting Jordan Spieth level dominance, but you have to like his trajectory as a 25-year-old who's just in his second year on tour.
All right, I'll clean that up. You're right. I wouldn't project that on anyone either, because that's unfair expectations. I think what I was saying is, just in general, these players who are winning these full field events, these are going to be the players that become the next stars. Because if you go back 5 years ago,
I would look at Jake Knapp.
Yeah, so like I don't even want to put a name on it. My point is that these players who are emerging in these events, that's the category. That's where you're going to get your inventory from. Those players need to become the next stars going forward. Because as you pointed out, and I wanted to make sure I got this 100% correctly, as you said earlier today on national TV, and I quote, "The PGA Tour is bereft of star power." Clip that. If we could play it again, I would gladly.
I see no lies.
You're going to be tiptoeing around TPC Sawgrass in 2 weeks, but expand on that.
I mean, I think it's a fact that there's 4 or 5 players on the PGA Tour who could walk into a restaurant and be recognized. And I think LIV has done a very smart thing over the past couple of years. If you look at the inaugural Player Impact Program standings, those players are, by the PGA Tour's own metric, the most popular players, the most meaningful players, the players who resonate deepest with fan bases. LIV has taken 6 of those 10 players, more than half, and you can probably say that the PGA Tour does not have a 7th in Tiger Woods, who is no longer a full-time player on the PGA Tour. And so that leaves Rory McIlroy, Justin Thomas, and Jordan Spieth. Rory, I think, is in his own category. He's clearly the face of the modern PGA Tour, but he's had a slow start to 2024. Jordan Spieth has won just twice on the PGA Tour since 2017, and Justin Thomas is just now emerging from the worst slump of his career. That's it. Who else is going to fill the void that has been left by all of these LIV defections? Max Homa, very slow start to 2024. Victor Hovland, reigning FedEx Cup champion, very slow start to 2024. Scottie Scheffler has not won in 51 weeks. He's not won on the PGA Tour in 51 weeks since last year's Players' Championship. Someone has to step up. And so when you look at these full field events on the PGA Tour, 6 of the 9 now have been quote-unquote long shots, 100-to-1 odds or greater. Those events are doing exactly what they should. they should be offering the redemption story of Grayson Murray. They should be the crowning of an amateur Nick Dunlap winning on the PGA Tour. They should be providing a launching spot for the Jake Knapps and the Austin Eckroats of the world to find their footing on the PGA Tour. What I'm most curious about is what happens this week at Bay Hill with these signature events, putting all the best players in the PGA Tour together at a high profile event. If you do not have a star, I'm talking a bold faced star winning this tournament, you gotta have be you gotta be having alarm bells at Ponte Vedra.
You're willing to call it after API that, that signature events are a failure? If we get I'm not even gonna throw a name out there because
I think I think the concept is good. And that's to take nothing away from Wyndham Clark or Hideki Matsuyama. I mean, Wyndham Clark's the reigning US Open champion. Hideki Matsuyama is the winningest player ever on the PGA Tour from Asia. Like those are marquee players, but they do not yet resonate with hugely American fan bases. And so the PGA Tour has to have a Rory win, a Scotty win, a Max win, a player with cachet who is a proven commodity, because that's what this entire thing was built about. And no one has really discussed this, Rex. The PGA, it should be easier to win on the PGA Tour, not harder, in this new era. If the PGA Tour has been weakened by all these star players going to LIV, and LIV, you know, you can talk about the competition level on that side, but if you focus strictly on the PGA Tour, it should be easier for the Rorys and the Scotties and the JTs to win. And yet that has not been the case over the past year or two.
I'll push back a little bit on the idea of the PIP, because you've thrown that one out there on numerous occasions. And I just want to go back to the heart of that was a silly list. They don't even use the criteria.
Wasn't that silly?
It was very silly. And that's why they don't use that criteria.
DJ,
they have since reworked that list dramatically, how they come up with it. I think it's because they realize they lean too much into sort
popularity.
Of the popularity part of it. And you didn't
mention Ricky Fowler. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about star power.
Oh, we are. Popularity. No, we are, absolutely. And I would go to the idea that it's a lack of personality, not a lack of talent, I guess, would be my argument, my counter. Because it seems to me there is still just a monsoon. There is still more talent on the PGA Tour than there is on LIV Golf. The stars, it seems like, sort of...
The personalities.
That Q score that you want to look at, that's leaning further and further towards LIV Golf, which I think is the quote that I tried to bury you with just now, which you were trying to get at. It's the personalities of the Bryson DeChambeaus and the Brooks Koepkas and the Bubba Watsons. Those are the ones you miss the most. And I will totally agree with that. I think that original PIP list was ridiculous. I mean, just the way they came up with it. And I would also counter and say that was going to be an evolving thing. It was going to be a living thing year in and year out.
You say it was ridiculous. I would argue that's actually the most important metric is popularity, is the Q score, is the recognizability of fans to those players, right? Those are the people who, when they get into contention, casual fans will say, oh, I know Brooks. I know DJ. I know Bubba. I know Bryson. I'm going to tune in. And that's going to then boost the ratings. Without those players, it's just kind of a shrug. It's just another very talented player on the PGA Tour who perhaps doesn't have a radiant personality.
Again, I go back to the idea that they use that formula 1 year and there was pushback and they realized it was a bad way to come up with the formula. They don't even do it anymore, really. So it essentially is what I'm trying to argue. I would say, though, going forward, you have to end up with those types of winners to sort of make everything evolve. It can't be the same top 10 players year in and year out, because that's what LIV Golf is going to run into eventually, where it just becomes static. You're playing against each other. Put it in the context of what's going on in the college football playoffs right now. The idea now is that if you come up with some sort of super league that's only going to include the SEC and the Big Ten, that to me does not sound very appealing. It might sound very appealing to someone like you who's an SEC homer, but the idea that all they're going to do is play each other year in and year out, like there's never going to be the opportunity for a Washington to step up, or I don't know, a UCLA or someone else to step up and make a difference and to create some excitement and create some interest. I would say it's the same thing that's going to happen on LIV Golf. And the PGA Tour does not have that problem, but I would agree they have a name recognition problem, 100%.
Yeah, I think the PGA Tour has actually done a very good job of keeping the meritocracy where, you know, you can quibble with these sponsor exemptions. And I know we got into that with the fact that Webb Simpson and Adam Scott receiving sponsor exemptions into Bay Hill. But look at who are they leaving out? Like, I think the PGA Tour has actually done a good job with these signature events of still promoting from within, still offering upward mobility for the Jake Knapps and the Austin Eckroats of the world to basically change their career with 1 week, and then they can parlay that into bigger and better things. I think once you lose that aspect, and I think that's one of the main drawbacks of kind of Rory's fictional 80-person world tour, is that it will get a little bit monotonous to see the exact same players playing over and over again. You can put it all over the world. You can change up some of the formats, but when it's the same players and you don't have any influx of players in season, I think that's potentially where you are going to lose some folks. Just mentioned Rory. Another kind of ho-hum finish, Rex, at least this on the first leg of the Florida swing. That kind of follows ho-hum finishes as well at Pebble Beach and then Riviera as well. It is interesting because when you look back at his 2023, this is almost exactly what happened a year ago, where he wins in Dubai, has kind of a slow start, and then starts to cook a little bit as he gets into Florida. Where's your level of concern, 0 to 10, 10 being the most, as it relates to Rory, who now just has 3 starts left before Augusta?
It's definitely not 10, and it's definitely not 0. I know that probably doesn't help you. I put it at 3 or 4. It would be very, very low, simply because you look at his ball striking last week, first in the field, off the tee, first in the field, strokes gained, tee to green. It's normal Rory stuff, and he talked about this after his round yesterday. When he's doing that well, everything else just needs to fall into place. And what hasn't fallen into place, and again, his putting is an example, he lost more than 3.5 strokes to the field down at PGA National. That's not going to get it done. I don't care how well you're striking the golf ball. I still like the idea of what he's trying to do. And I think you hit on it well when you referred to it like his own spring training. And let me go out and get myself into the best possible shape, so when I show up at Augusta National, I don't have to worry about any part of my game. Everything should be clicking. I don't think that's the way it's going to work out, because I feel like at that point, it's such an exhausting week and you've already probably taxed your body and your mind and everything else to the extremes. I don't think this is the winning formula for him, but it will be interesting to see how it plays out.
I think the point is that I think we were seduced by Tiger thinking that, oh, it's just, you just got to peak for the majors. Like everyone, yeah,
he made it sound
everyone,
easy.
Everyone can just peak for the majors. Well, it's really not that easy. And so Rory's philosophy is, I'm trying to get to the year's first major and maintain for the rest of the season, as opposed to picking out a point in the calendar and be like, yep, everything ramps up to there. And so you're most likely to do that by being game ready and being tournament proven, which is what he's trying to do. He's going to be playing 8 tournament starts by the time the year's first major rolls around. I do think we'd be having an entirely different conversation with Rory if he did not hit a bad tee shot in the 72nd hole in his first event in Dubai. He very easily could have then gone back to back, and then you're looking at a kind of entirely different resume. I think if it continues this week at Bay Hill, which puts such a premium on driving the golf ball, and Rory is still the world's best driver of the golf ball on the PGA Tour, if it continues this week at a golf course where he has 6 top tens and 9 career starts and is seemingly in contention each and every year, as he was last year, eventually losing to Kurt Kitayama, then I think it's reasonable to wonder if he is where he needs to be with the Masters now just a month away. But I'm with you. I'm not ready to pull any sort of alarm bells as it relates to Rory.
And I'm going to say 2 swings. You brought up the one in Dubai. I'm going to bring up the one on Saturday at PGA National. Like, look, he was trying to play the hero shot out of the water and ended up making a triple bogey, but things could have
gone. Don't hit it there.
Absolutely. I'm not making excuses for him. Like, he's the one that ended up in there and then tried to play the hero shot and it didn't work out. But you can make an argument that 2 swings could have gone either way and we'd be having a much different conversation about it.
Rex, what else stood out to you from the week that was, as we now enter another week with the signature event series?
We didn't really touch on Joaquin. I mean, you have to be impressed. And I was kind of shocked because I wrote a story this morning that the PGA of America has offered him a special invitation. And look, that's their words, not mine. And I have kind of gotten called out on X, formerly Twitter, because they're like, oh, why does he need a special invitation? Well, that's what they call it. I don't. That's not for me to decide what they call it. They should have. They have historically given special invitations to players who are inside the top 100 in the world ranking who aren't otherwise qualified. They did it last year for 8 LIV players, including Paul Casey, who was 131st in the world. So I will give the PGA of America credit. They have been the pointy end of the spear in this. And we've had these conversations over and over, and they're not going to go away because it's going to become a bigger problem as we go down the road, that these players from LIV are going to fall out of all of these categories. And it's going to become an issue that they're not playing in the major championships. As long as it seems like the major championship bodies are trying, and I will give Augusta National credit, who offered Joaquin, who gave Joaquin a special invitation, and the PGA of America credit for doing it. They recognize not only what he did last year winning the Australian Open, but they also recognize the fact that, look, he's won two LIV events. I was the one that argued, I think, at the end of last year that Brooks Koepka should have been on the ballot for the GWA Male Player of the Year based on what he did, just not in the majors, obviously what he did in the majors, but he also had a heck of a season on LIV Golf. I'm not of the mindset to dismiss a victory in LIV Golf anymore. Cause as we just had the conversation, yeah, they got a bunch of cachet and a bunch of big names and they can carry storylines, but they also have really, really talented players.
I do find it interesting, Rex, that the PGA has actually proven to be the most flexible major when it comes to inviting. And you never would have thought that 3 years ago. Remember Seth Waugh at Kiowa kind of dismissed the idea of the Saudi funding in golf and the idea of kind of a breakaway league. And then we heard what he and others said 2022 at Southern Hills. And yet they're the ones who invited Paul Casey this year. They're the ones who have now reached out and extended a special invitation, as you say, to Joaquin Neiman. And again, I don't think it's specifically because of his LIV performance. His LIV performance has become so good that it's impossible to ignore. Yeah. But I think they also are recognizing the lengths he is going, Joaquin Neiman is, to improve his world ranking. And could he have potentially stayed inside the top 100, which is kind of their unofficial guideline for how they give out exemptions to the PGA? Probably, maybe. I'm not sure. I'm not Nosferatu. He's currently 72nd in the world. Perhaps he would have fallen out with his divisor by the time May rolls around. But I do like the fact that they're stepping back, kind of removing themselves from the animosity of golf's current civil war, and just recognizing that good golf is played in other places than just the PGA Tour.
And we had a pretty pointed discussion about this. Now, the other side of this coin is Joaquin complaining about the world ranking again on Sunday after he wins in Saudi Arabia. Look, man, like it's a non-starter. They just need to let it go. It's a waste of energy. It's a waste of effort. Like, you were sold a bill of goods by LIV Golf and Greg Norman. That's just not going to come due. Like, this just is not going to happen anytime soon. It might happen sometime in the future, but the world ranking has made it perfectly clear that, nope, we're not comfortable with the team aspect, and we can work our way around 54 holes, shotgun starts, all of that. It's the team aspect that's making them uncomfortable. So work on a better solution, which is what we just talked about. Get with the PGA of America. Try to make them understand that, look, our players are still really, really good players. You don't want to play your major championship without the best possible field. And if you don't have our players, I'm not talking about all of them. Like, there has to be a limit here, but you need our top players to complete your major. And I think they need to make that same pitch to all four major championships.
Do you think, Rex, this is actually Joaquin Neiman kvetching about his place in the world rankings? Or do you think he's merely reading off kind of the LIV talking points? Because I've known Joaquin since he was a junior player. He has been anything but a whiner throughout his career. I found him to be very accommodating. I found him to be thoughtful, introspective. It just seems so counter to his personality to be so dug in on a concept that really doesn't concern him. As we've now seen, the majors may bend the rules a little bit to accommodate these players if they're doing the right thing, if they're performing at a level that just can't be ignored. What do you think the actual motivation is for him to be making these sort of gripes?
It might be that, look, these are the talking points, because, look, it's going to mirror what we see in society, certainly in politics, where you just need to start saying things louder and louder and over again. And eventually the hope is, we've seen it happen, where the lie just becomes reality. And in this particular case, the lie is that Greg Norman promised all these players that they would get world ranking points. You can keep saying it over and over again, and I don't know, maybe in my lifetime it will happen, but it just seems to me it's such a waste of time and energy right now for a player like Joaquin Neiman, who has proven that, look, I can play well on LIV Golf, and I can go out of my way and play in these other events and try to connect the dots that way, and I'm going to get recognized. He's qualified for three of this year's four majors and can still qualify through a number of avenues for the U.S. Open. So if a player And I will go to any player on LIV Golf who continues to complain about this Taylor Gooch being the primary one, number one on the hit list, is you have avenues. You may not like those avenues. You may not have the energy or want to put the effort into it, but there are avenues. And you just sitting there repeating the talking points is not going to work, at least not now.
I think that's what the main issue with Taylor Gooch's gripe was. And Taylor Gooch had a phenomenal season last year on LIV, was a leading points earner, banked more than $30 million. Like it was a very good year. And yet he's played just one other event that was recognized by the official world golf ranking. He could have very easily done what Joaquin Neiman has done over the past couple of months and chase points elsewhere. And maybe that then would have been recognized by these major organizations that has not yet come to fruition. Sausage finger is up.
If you had your choice, just out of curiosity, Erik van Rooyen finished up. He was one of the lucky few who finished up his round on Sunday at PGA National before the storms came and decided to go ahead and play in the Seminole Pro Member, which is a very elite event. It has a lot of tour players. It probably has the best field of the Florida swing, however it is you want to define it. Would you have done it if you were Erik? Would you have gone over to Seminole, which isn't that far from PGA National, but given the idea that something could have happened coming down the stretch and he would have had to get in the car and race back over to PGA National?
So I saw that he was going to play this morning and they were going to keep him abreast of a situation. And he had said kind of two shots for the player heading into the bear trap. So with four holes left, if he was two shots behind, they likely would have shuttled him back to PGA National to get ready. Why couldn't they just change the tee times?
I was thinking about this.
Why was there this flood of withdrawals or players being upset that they couldn't do both? Why would you just not move them to the afternoon? I know daylight savings time hasn't hit, but the last tee time, I believe, was at 1:30. And so they still could have accommodated them if need be. Fortunately for Erik van Rooyen, it was a moot point.
Yes, 1:30. 1:30 was the last tee time. And you're right. They could have shuffled all those guys to the back end, and it could have been much easier. I don't know why. It seems curious. And look, I've covered the Seminole event. It's so much fun. The golf course is phenomenal. Bob Ford is the best in the business. I don't know that I would have taken that chance. Just me.
Rex, this is your favorite week on the PGA Tour schedule, a home game at Bay Hill. I'm saying that with tongue firmly planted in cheek. You're heading out there tomorrow on Tuesday. What are your expectations for the week? What are you hoping to get out of it?
I got to do a lot of begging because I've got I have more ticket requests this year than I've ever had, and not just tickets for Bay Hill. Here's the rub. Is not only am I having to get tickets, but bunkmate wants tickets for her and some friends, and she keeps asking, there's no way you can get me into a suite. And I keep telling her, no, there's no way I can get her into a suite. Apparently, she doesn't understand how those things work. So that's difficult enough. And then I've got tickets I have to get for folks on Saturday. But on top of all of that, I've got a group of caddies who asked me if I can get them tickets to the UCF Houston game on Wednesday night. So you get an idea of why this is not the most enjoyable week of the year for me.
That makes no mention of the traffic, of the
basketball
golf course,
game, by the way, basketball,
the
game.
Food, anything else that goes into the Arnold Palmer Invitational. So for yours, Rex, and all those ticket requests that you're getting and potentially getting the hospitality, I have that exact same conversation with my wife and my friends next week in a bigger event, the PGA Tour's flagship event, which should absolutely be electric, with Tiger Woods' expected return, it being spring break week in St. John's County. Like, it's going to be absolutely massive. And yes, I too am struggling to get my loved ones into a hospitality tent. But hey, that's what happens. Grounds passes are good enough for me.
And we did have a silly conversation on the roundtable this morning on Golf Today, and I don't know that I got your thoughts. The idea that Tiger is using today's Seminole Pro Member, playing in it for the first time, that to me is a little surprising, but all right, like he normally doesn't go in for those types of things, that he's using it as some sort of tune-up for next week is just downright silly to me. Because look, it's a lot of things. It's a lot of fun.
I do think he's desperate for any sort of tournament action. It doesn't matter if it's Pro Member. It doesn't matter if it's a hit and giggle. Like, he just has
business.
Not played enough.
No. It's business. Look, Jimmy Dunn, I'm pretty sure he's still the president of Seminole Golf Club. He's an independent director on the PGA Tour's policy board. He's one of the architects of the June 6th framework agreement. He's playing close to Tiger. Tiger's playing with Seth Wall, the CEO of the PGA of America. This is a chance for all of the important people in golf to get together before we get to the Masters and have conversations that you and I can only wish we could be part of.
Yeah, it'd certainly be fun to be a fly on the wall for this one. Unfortunately, you and I did not get the invite. Potentially we get maybe a sponsor exemption, special invitation, whatever you want to call it, for the 2025 edition. Fingers crossed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. You can see me for the next 2 days, unless I get canceled on Golf Today. Rex, you'll be out at Bay Hill. I'm sure we'll be calling you in for a couple hits as well. Make sure you guys go to nbcsports.com/golf for the latest news, notes, commentary, features, and anything else in the world of golf. Rex's reports, Brently Romine, will also be on site this week at the Arnold Palmer Invitational before we get to the flagship event of the PGA Tour, the Players' Championship, the crown jewel. And we'll be doing this podcast, this very podcast, this recap podcast from my backyard. Look forward to doing that one as always. In the meantime, we'll be back in 2 days for a full preview of the Arnold Palmer Invitational with some takes, the player interviews that come through, and anything else that happens for the next 48 hours. Thank you guys, as always, for listening. Talk to you in a couple of days. All the news takes.